And they were kind of in a nice arc with the bluegrass world. So it was one of those things where the people I had on my iPod, sometimes they would be sitting in the audience looking at us, and that was a big adjustment mentally, just to try and, just get used to playing for the people that I transcribe and listen to.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Joe K. Walsh is an acclaimed master of the bluegrass mandolin and a professor at Berklee College. And in this episode, you'll hear about many of his inspiring collaborations, including with Daryl Anger, Mike Block, Grant Gordy, Alex Hargreaves, and Mike Marshall. We are featuring some music from some of his albums, including If Not Now, Who? We talked about Joe's approach as an educator, the challenges and joys of the touring life, the importance of innovation and taking chances musically. Joe's love of music and the mandolin shines brightly in this candid conversation. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms. And I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. The podcast theme music was commissioned from composer Nick Cold, and you can use the timestamps to navigate the episode. Before we jump into our conversation, I wanted to let you know that you can support this independent podcast through a beautiful collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly. This weekly podcast is in season 4, and I send out an email newsletter where you can get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including the merch store, links for Joe's music, and also the support link to buy this independent podcaster a coffee. Hey, Joe, thanks for joining me here today.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So far, the only other mandolinist I've had on the series is Aaron Weinstein, who introduced us.
One of my favorites. What a beautiful musician and human he is.
And the first time I was aware of your playing was actually a little YouTube video you guys did under lockdown, one of those remote things.
Those things are generally hard, but with Aaron, it worked out pretty good. I found that to be a challenging era, to say that, to understate the huge statement. But with Aaron, that was a lot of fun. It felt like actually making music with another human being.
Yeah. And he's a jazz mandolinist, for people who don't know his playing. You're coming from a bluegrass background, but incorporating jazz language, which we'll get into. Have you learned from Aaron at all?
Sure, yeah, definitely. I hadn't seen him in a long time, but we were students at the same time at Berklee. Mm-hmm. We would, have an opportunity to play and hang. And then more recently, I've transcribed a bunch of, some of his stuff, and it's just cool to have another such a fresh perspective on what's possible on the mandolin. He's really doing something that no one else is doing it, and he's doing it really well.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting.
So since we agreed to do this interview, I've been listening to so many of your fabulous albums, just one after another, an incredible collection of collaborators, and we'll get into various groups you play with. I believe you've just recorded a new album, which will be out in a few months.
Yeah, I got to figure out if I like it.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
I mean, that's like I feel like that's where we should be making music, is like on that edge of, like, it shouldn't be just safe,
yeah.
Right? And that's where this record is. I decided to, for a long time I've been, grousing about the way, my perception, the mandolin world is sort of dominated by, like a excess, overstatement, shred, maximalism, mm-hmm. however you want to say it. And I've always kind of been frustrated that there isn't a Martin Hayes, who I know you had in your podcast, or there isn't a Bill Frisell, or there isn't, there's not a contrasting statement. And there's Andrew Marlin, and I think he's doing a really beautiful job of making argument for less is more, kind of. But that's kind of the notion of this record, is I was trying to make a quiet record.
Okay.
And now I got to see if it's too quiet.
Well, you can always use some of it. And
that's right.
Figure that out. Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing what comes of that. Well, your most recent album, I believe, that I've listened to is If Not Now, Who?
Right.
And that title, how'd you come up with that?
Well, it's sort of related, actually. Like, in the sense of, like I say, I'm grousing about what I wish were happening in the larger mandolin community or the bluegrass community. And instead of just, I kind of have a feeling like if I'm going to complain about something, I either have to fix it or accept it, right? And that's where that title comes to mind, is like, something should be happening.
Yeah.
So
playing with the if not now, when.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a beautiful tune on there, Tom, that I believe has a special dedication.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, this is such a pandemic record. Most of those tunes were written in the pandemic. And one of the big moving things for me in my experience of the pandemic was the way people were being creative about supporting and reaching out. And some people were especially were looking out for the musicians that they cared about. And one day I just got a huge chunk of money Venmo'd to me from this friend of mine, Tom, in Florida. And it was the same day I had written that tune, and it felt like a fitting, tribute to his kindness. The funny thing about that tune is, in my understanding, it's very peaceful, and he's a very loud, frenetic dude, and it's a funny fit. But also, this big gentle act certainly warranted some kind acknowledgement.
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful tune. I was hoping we could share it as part of the episode.
Oh, great. Yeah, cool.
You're about to hear Tom from Joe's album, If Not Now, Who? Please check the links in the show notes to find all the music featured in this episode. that album was recorded in this, I believe, this farmhouse in Maine that's sort of off-grid, kind of?
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of, I think maybe Lake Street Dive kind of put it on the map, or it's owned by the piano player from Josh Ritter's band, and a lot of, like, the bands from Boston will do a retreat, and, you know, for a while, I don't think there was internet, and I think that was a selling point, you know, on some level. So it's a nice place to go hole up, and it's, you know, whenever you record, you're compromising on some aspect, I think, like, what's the most important thing, like the most beautiful room or isolation or getting, you know, in that case, it's really nice to get away from, we don't have any friends anywhere there, you know, there's nothing there. That's not fully true. There's a small town, but there's almost like, there's not even a grocery store nearby, so you really are just hunkered down with your crew, and I think that's a beautiful way to make a record.
Okay, so you spent a couple of days together.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's really, really beautiful record.
Thank you.
Now, yeah. You mentioned you met Aaron at Berklee, and I heard somewhere that you were the first mandolin player to be accepted as a student.
Kind of, yeah, right. So there was, I think, I mean, basically there hadn't been a mandolin teacher until I got there, and then they hired John McGann. But I think that there had been, so for example, John McGann went to Berklee.
Okay.
And he was a guitar student, but he was a fantastic mandolin player too. And there's a couple people like that. Hide, I've forgotten his last name. There's a couple people who went through Berklee and are fantastic mandolin players. But then at some point, there was an openness to accepting, you know, the banjo and the mandolin and sort of broadening what was permissible at the school in terms of instruments, and that happened to be coinciding with the time I was, you know, knocking on the door.
Okay.
Proverbially.
Yeah, and of course Aaron was accepted as a violinist, which is, yeah, people don't know that. Now, you've taught there for many years. I'm curious how the school has changed since you were a student to all the years you've been teaching there.
Well, there's a lot more roots music, roots, quote-unquote. There's a lot more mandolin players. Generally speaking, there's like, you know, 8 to 10 mm-hmm. or 11 at any semester, and there's a lot more, you know, bluegrass there, like fantastic fiddle players and of all styles. So that scene has really, really blossomed since I was there as a student, which is, I guess, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you teach composition.
I teach mandolin, actually, mostly private lessons, and then I have two ensembles, one of which is sort of like a, like I'm really interested in the string band stuff that happened since, like, let's say the 70s and 80s, and like that was kind of doing this expansive thing in the quote unquote bluegrass world. So like Grisman and Bela Fleck and many Edgar Meyer and Darryl and Mike Marshall. I love that, and I have an ensemble that kind of focuses on that, and then I have one that's about tune writing. So yeah, I guess you're right.
That's the class I meant, because I heard you talk about it in another interview, and it was interesting to me and inspiring that you're bringing your tunes to them. Everyone has to bring something.
Yeah. Yeah, teaching is funny, because like, I think teaching, in my experience of trying to become a better musician, it involves a very stark assessment of what I'm doing and what's working and what's not. But as someone who tries to be a gentle human being, not every student benefits from fully stark statements, right? Like there's people who are just like, I don't feel comfortable really, you know, tearing somebody's tune apart, really, is the answer.
Yeah.
And I've read some like essays about like about how other people teach writing and arguing for like, yes, keep going, you know, as opposed to, this is terrible. You can't really do that. And I think like, trying to be encouraging and then using my tunes as a lens for, here's this thing that didn't work. What can we fix? Here's this thing that maybe worked. Let's all take a critical eye. And I feel really comfortable using that as a vehicle for actually inviting, you know, more nuanced critique and really trying to model that.
Mm-hmm. So do your students sometimes, well, they must give you valuable feedback that affects your writing.
That's true, yeah. And and it's a different crew, of course, every semester. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll bring in a tune, like for example on that record, If Not Now, who I brought in the tune 41 Years, which I had written on my parents' anniversary, and I was pretty certain I was done, except for one chord. I was missing, like, basically the punchline. I was like, I have this beautiful thing, but I know something needs to happen, and I don't know what it is. And one of the tremendously talented musicians, Minnie Jordan, was like, "Here's the chord," and it was really the perfect chord. So it was kind of a beautiful. It ended up being a co-write, and that happens sometimes. And yeah, being open to learn from and their suggestions, it's really, I think, healthy, and it's been hugely beautiful for me.
Mm-hmm. So aside from the high-level players you're teaching at Berklee, you teach privately, you do workshops, you work with amateurs. And I was curious, you must get people who are fiddle players going to mandolin as well as guitarists going to mandolin, I'm guessing.
Sure, yeah.
So that must present different challenges.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I mean, obviously the fiddle players going to mandolin know the left hand, and then guitarists would have right hand, facility, generally speaking. So yeah, they're different challenges. I kind of think most students are different challenges. I've always kind of chafed a little bit at the concept of, like, what is your curriculum in private lessons, because some people take for granted that they know, understand, like, triads or note and chord relationship, and that's a given. And then other people, that takes a couple of years, and vice versa with techniques. I think you're of course right about different challenges with those two instruments, but I tend to think I try and be as adaptive to each student as possible, no matter what the background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the few times I picked up a mandolin, I played violin my whole life, it just felt strange. Like, I thought it would be so familiar, but it feels very different.
It's much, it requires much more effort on your left hand, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like I was cheated once I realized how much effort it takes to put the string down on the violin.
Well, less effort on the violin, yeah. Yeah, if we could talk about your life as a singer and a songwriter. There's an earlier album, Borderland, and you have a tune on there, Innisfree, based on the poetry of Yeats, right?
Yeah, yeah. An adaptation of his poem, actually. Mm-hmm. Just I was trying to be really persnickety and make sure I didn't lose any syllable in his poem.
Okay.
And I think that kind of ties in with one of the things I like to do with tune writing. I don't even remember where this idea came from. It probably wasn't mine, but looking through poetry books, sometimes you find poems that suggest here's a rhythm, or maybe this is a pair, or this is, obviously there's rhyme schemes. That's a big concept, of course. Everybody knows that. But sometimes those sorts of patterns can suggest, a melodic rhythm is my experience of it. And so sometimes I'll pour through books and just get a melody out of it, and that's a big win. And then sometimes I'm not a big lyricist. I don't write a lot of lyrics. So for a while, when I was trying to construct songs more actively, that was another thing. It's like looking for poems that would lend themselves to becoming songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like the Yeats ones worked really well. I did a bunch of those.
Okay. So could we share that song?
Oh, please, yeah.
Next is Innisfree from Joe's album Borderland.
I will arrive. I shall have some peace there. For peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. At midnight's all a glimmer, noon a purple glow, and evening's full of the linnet's wings. And I will arise and go now, for always night and day. I hear lake water lapping, those sounds by the shore. When I stand out on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core.
So one of your big early breaks was with the Gibson brothers, and you toured widely with them. So that bluegrass tradition of singing in close harmony, is that something that just, it must feel amazing. Like I've never done anything like that.
You know, I didn't sing with them because their whole thing was, I didn't sing very much with them. Once in a while it happened, but their whole brand is about the brother duet. And once in a while there was a space for a third person to sing, but yeah, just being, I feel like they're the masters of that thing right now. And it's cool in the sense of like, you could picture them as the heirs to the lineage of like the Stanley brothers, or other great brother duets. And it was really powerful to, you know, get a chance to collaborate with them. And it's so natural. And one thing that was really interesting about them is like the brother duet thing, you know, everybody talks about, or perceives it as like, it's such a great blend because they grew up singing together. But if you listen to them sing individually, they don't sound like each other at all. It's very interesting. And then they learned how to sing together very well, but it's not about like, they sound so similar that it's such a perfect blend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking more about just the type of harmonization in that style. But I was also curious to know about those touring years. I mean, you were pretty young and touring in Europe and all over the States.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Well, I was young, but I had been in bands enough as a co-leader or bands that I'd started. So I had enough experience on the road trying to book gigs and hotels and all this kind of chaos to really appreciate when I joined the Gibson brothers that I just showed up and played the mandolin and I tried to do the best I could with that. So that was a, you know, very privileged position with them. And they were kind of in a nice arc with the bluegrass world. So it was one of those things where the people I had on my iPod, sometimes they would be sitting in the audience looking at us. And that was a big adjustment mentally, just to try and, you know, just, get used to playing for the people that I transcribe and listen to. I think it's taken me a long time to appreciate the degree to which the mental game is as important as anything else, and that was a big learning curve with them.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of touring strategies, I mean, you're on the road a lot, except for COVID, so it is a challenging lifestyle. Do you have any tips or habits that help?
Trying to have less expectations is not a pithy. I mean, you know, when I've encountered tension, be it with myself or with anybody else, collaborators or, you know, hosts, it's just like I should be open to whatever is going to happen and my expectations of what should happen in a given moment at a gas station, in a hotel, whatever, are not everybody's. And trying to remember that is important. And also, like, I don't know. I have my usual haunts all over the country now. Like, I have all my favorite coffee shops in various places. And trying to make time for that and taking it on a walk and always having a nice book with me. I've been very lucky that, like, the people I play with these days are people I consider my closest friends, which isn't always the easiest thing, and it doesn't, you know, like my mom always said, like, if you want to really know somebody, travel with them, and that's what I do for work, and it's not always perfect, but I'm very privileged that I, you know, these people I care and love and care about and am inspired by are the people I get to travel with. So I always, you know, try and keep that in mind too, that even if I'm just sitting in an airport and I hate airports, I'm here with these people that I love, and I'm such a privileged person to get to be there with them.
Yeah. And how about traveling with your mandolins? How does that work?
It's not really a big deal. Lately I've been making more records that involve the mandolin and the mandola and the octave mandolin and sometimes the cello. That becomes a bigger deal. But for most of my time, I've just been traveling with the mandolin, and it's really never an issue.
Small enough, yeah. Well, let's talk about the mandolin family and maybe the Gur mandolin band.
Oh, yeah, cool. Yeah. Yeah, so as some people know, there's, you know, people are familiar with the violin and the viola and the cello, and there's a mandolin equivalent of all of those, oddly enough. So there's, of course, the mandolin is what people are most familiar with, but there's a mandola tuned like a viola. And then there's an octave mandolin, which kind of adds another step as you go down. So that's an octave below the mandolin. And that's kind of been coming to prominence after, like, folks like Tim O'Brien and Matt Flinner, and then more recently, Sarah Jarosz and other folks have really made that, move that to the center of what they're creating. And it, as someone who mostly plays the mandolin, it presented some beautiful options as an accompanist, as a singer, as someone who doesn't always want it to sound bright and happy, you know, like the mandolin is so high and it's a beautiful thing, but it, both with the octave mandolin and the mandola, it's nice to have like a representative sound of other emotional parts of the, you know, other parts of the emotional spectrum.
Yeah. I think you mentioned David Grisman earlier, and I believe in high school it was one of his records that turned you on to the mandolin, right?
Yeah. So I had a classmate, and I wish I remembered his name, who just one day offhand played me the first David Grisman quintet record, which for people like me and a lot of people who I looked up to in other generations, that was like a, you know, just earth-shattering record, just a really fully realized, fresh take on what was possible with these instruments. And for anybody that doesn't know it, it was David Grisman on a mandolin. The first iteration had Todd Phillips on the second mandolin, and then Daryl Langer on the violin, and Tony Rice, the amazing bluegrass guitarist on guitar, and Bill Lamatnick, I believe, on the first record. But it was sort of this beautiful amalgamation of all these things that I had started to care about, which is bluegrass, but also swing and jazz. And as someone who grew up in northern Minnesota, I'm not really a bluegrass dude, and I listened to Monk when I was doing my homework and Django and stuff, and then here's this really fully realized example of that you can kind of blend all these things and make something really exciting, totally amazing music, life-changing, really.
And you've gone on to meet and maybe work with David Grisman?
Yeah, I got to know David. He invited me to teach at his symposium, and he's always been very very kind to me, which is just it actually it was basically true throughout the whole mandolin world. All the people that I looked up to, they've always been really kind. There's so many mandolin players, but it feels like they're all willing to, I don't know, be friendly and give a little space to everybody. It's really a beautiful thing.
That is.
Yeah. So, yeah, I got to know David a little bit, not as well as Daryl. Daryl was the violin player, of course, in that first record, and I've been collaborating with him for about 15 years.
Yeah, in many groups, including Mr. Sun, which is a fabulous ensemble.
Thanks, yeah.
I've listened to a couple of your Mr. Sun albums, including the Nutcracker Suite, the Ellington Strayhorn adaptation. It's really brilliant and fun.
Thanks. You know, my favorite thing about that band is that we're willing to try things.
Yeah.
Like, we did this gig in the winter, and it was maybe one of the biggest gigs of the winter for us. A very, you know, nice large audience. And there was one tune that, as we were coming towards the end of that tune, we were all doing different things than we'd ever done before. And we just really committed, and we kind of are building up to the ending, and nobody knows how it's going to end. And then it kind of crashed and burned, but that was my favorite thing, because it was just such an example of us just like being willing to try stuff, even in this setting where previously we might have been inclined to go towards safety. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like my favorite thing about that band, is like we're just willing to give ideas a whirl, and not everything works, of course, but we're discovering some fun stuff along the way, I think.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. You know what? We skipped over the Gur Mandolin Ensemble. We started talking about the mandolin family.
We can come back.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, so of course, all those mandolins in the mandolin family, there used to be mandolin orchestras all over the country and all over the world, really. And I've been luckily collaborating with the great mandolin player Mike Marshall, who is leading an ensemble called the Gur Mandolin Ensemble. And the conceit of this ensemble is trying to recreate music that would have been played by Jewish mandolin orchestras in Eastern Europe around the time of World War II. In creating this ensemble, before I was part of it, they actually hired somebody to go around to used bookstores and thrift stores and try and find old music that could have been what they played, and then in addition to that, making their best guesses about, you know, Polish music or this music, and that's been a really inspiring project and very moving. I mean, it's very heavy.
Yeah, I believe that there was that tradition through the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, and then in some countries it persists.
Yeah.
Like in Germany, it's in every town, and there's actually a bunch in Japan. And there are some in the States, but it's not what it was.
Mm-hmm. It is a beautiful sound, and it must be very satisfying. Have you played different roles in that group in terms of mm-hmm. lower or higher?
Yeah. Yep. I play the mandola and the mandocello and the octave mandolin and the mandolin. I was lucky that through reading from Mike Marshall and with my time at Berkeley, I was really encouraged even forced to work on reading music, and that's a skill set that I'm really glad to have, and it's not a given in the mandolin world, so that's part of what makes that possible, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my children played mandolin for a while, and I remember I was looking what was available, you know, and I found this old Russian mandolin book, like a how-to book, and I bought it out of curiosity. I don't think she ever used it, but it was just very cool, though. Yeah, I should send it to you.
I would love to see that.
If we have it, I will send it to you.
Amazing.
Joy Kills Sorrow, you got that started. They've disbanded, but that was
Yeah, that was a band that I started with some friends of mine when I was at Berkeley, and I mean, it's just hard to get a band off as a young person, and even that band, like, everybody's going on to good careers, and it's a really great band. But I ended up quitting because I had this opportunity with the Gibson Brothers and the Joy Kill Sorrow thing that I loved and it was amazing, but I wasn't making, you know, any money, like any. And then it was also like, I think when you're a young musician, you haven't realized, or not everybody has realized, that it's in your own interest to be as easy to be around and as easy to deal with. And at this point, as a 43-year-old dude, the bands I'm in mostly have acknowledged that, and it's much easier to be on the road. But in my early 20s, that's not a given. So that was like not an easy band. And I think it got better, but we all got better at that as we became adults properly.
Yeah. Looking back on my own like chamber music collaborations, I believe in my 20s I was much too stuck in my ways. Like if I had an idea, I just really needed to convince everybody of that. And I think now I'm much more, I really let go of things or much more willing to try other people's ideas. Do you find that a little bit?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, like my experience of my 20s is I was very confident that I was right.
Yeah. So I mean,
and like I was very confident that I should be hired. And this is well before, it really is well before like, that's correct. But luckily I still have friendships and I've survived with a lot of those nice relationships, and all people, gave me that space, which is a really invitation for me to do the same for my younger friends now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting how, when you enter the music business, I mean, I'm sure other professions are like this, but it's a huge range of ages and experience all working together often.
Right, totally. Yeah, which is a beautiful thing. I mean, it's an unusual, like I've been with my wife for 11 years, but when we first started, she works in the social justice field and is a lawyer now. I had students who were my collaborators that I was making records with, and that's just different. I think there's a gray area between generations in music, which I think I don't want to lose. But it's different than, obviously many other worlds. Mm-hmm. Having friends that I've, people that I consider friends that I've known since they were 12, but I was in my late 20s. That's unusual.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about Daryl Anger. I mean, you've worked with him for so many years. He's such a phenomenal multi-style violinist. What have you learned from him?
Quite a lot, I think. Yeah, probably more than I can express. A really key lesson I remember was I played on his record, and there's a thing in the bluegrass world where there's a large trend for a while now towards fixing everything that could be perceived as a mistake. And I think it's to bluegrass's detriment. Nobody's asking me from bluegrass but that's when I look at the reasons I don't listen to, that much bluegrass anymore. It's like there's no life left. And I kind of had a window into that. I did this, we were recording this tune and I played a solo and there was one note that I missed. Just one note, who cares, right? But I had come from making a bunch of records in Nashville and the standard operating procedure was, okay, fix it. Do this take. We'll take this little note and we could get that note from here. And you can construct a solo, which is kind of it's not a flattering way to say it. But that's how it's done a lot. And he pointed out, no, this is the gesture and this is the shape and that mistake. I was resistant at the time, but I'm totally on board. The records that I actually listen to, like if you listen to, there's so many beautiful records with Charlie Hayden playing duets with piano players. And like, for example, on Steal Away, where he's playing with Hank Jones, they don't play the downbeat perfectly all the time. It can be a little bit like da-da sometimes. Sometimes the same is true with him and Keith Jarrett. But that doesn't bother me. In fact, those are the records that I keep coming back to, and I had to accept that, mistakes are not, they're not going to capsize the whole concept. It's, in fact, getting rid of all of them might be the thing that capsizes the record.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. I wanted to let you know that I have a new way you can support this independent podcast through a beautiful collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly. You'll find that link in the description of the episode. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media and share my posts, and if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing. You'll find that link in the show notes along with the merch store. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now, back to the episode.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just kind of come to accept that the people that I listen to are just making something and then saying, that's what happened that day. And that's been a really good mindset for me. Like with this record last week, I was getting into this mindset of, like, what's the perfect way to do this? And I think that's really problematic. Like, it's a lesson that I kind of learned with Mr. Sun, and then I have to keep relearning that I don't think there should be a perfect thing. And really what it should be is, here's what happened this day with these people, and that's what happened, and that's cool. And maybe this tune will be played differently some other day with other people. And that's a much more healthy mindset for me to just say, okay, this is what's happening, instead of, like, really pushing away from the concept of, like, this is the definitive representative example of me or this tune or whatever. That's real problematic.
Have you or would you consider putting out an album where a tune is at the beginning and the end, but, like, different versions?
Yeah, I think that's cool. Like, totally. I haven't done that. But there's plenty of examples of that I like of that. And I actually was considering it on this record, and I may still do it depending on what happens with... you know, as I get to know this record, certainly, you know, changing instrumentation and maybe just doing a duet, that would be a nice thing.
Yeah. So you mentioned Minnesota growing up there. Do you know Adam Hurt, the old time band?
Yeah.
Because I interviewed him for this podcast as well.
Yeah. What a lovely, lovely dude, and very, very inspiring. He's so, you know, I always feel like the music should be enough, right? I don't think, like, I really kind of am bummed out when, like, you know, pyrotechnics or kind of what I would consider BS is put center stage. And Adam is such a antidote and such a extremely great example of the opposite. It's just like, here's this beautiful fiddle tune played perfectly with perfect timing and perfect sound, and it's so great. I love listening to him.
Yeah, and it was interesting talking to him because he just plays old tunes. He feels like there's so much repertoire, and he's happy just playing the same tunes and, you know, reimagining them.
Yeah.
It's very meditative, I think, his whole approach.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You write a lot of tunes, and what's your relationship to sort of the standards in terms of the bluegrass world or any other?
Oh, I still, you know, I play a lot of, you know, quote-unquote bluegrass gigs here in Maine when I'm home. I don't really do it much on the road as a prioritized thing professionally, but I still love those tunes. And you know, if you take any fiddle tune, Whiskey Before Breakfast or Angelina Baker, I expect myself to play that for the rest of my life and still be enjoying the challenge of trying to find something new to say on it. And, you know, the thing that I come out of is trying to improvise on these fiddle tunes, and that's the priority. So, you know, you could do that forever and try and have what you do on a given day reflect what you learned last week or how who you're mad at or all these things, like, affect, like, how many notes I'm choosing to play or whatever. And for better or for worse, that sustains my interest, so I'm happy to play those tunes. I think part of the reason I write tunes is just like, it's like they're just trying to. I grew up listening to so many different things, you know, from, of course, Grisman and Daryl, but also like Soul Coughing and Thelonious Monk or Django, or just like all these things, and I can't really turn off the stylistic. You know, a gumbo, and so that's just what's coming out. And I used to be more judgmental about writing things and then saying, well, this doesn't sound like that. But at some point there was a really significant shift where, you know, if what I said about Dog was, this doesn't sound like that, and that's really exciting, and that's really an important thing, acknowledging that that could be a strength instead of this fatal weakness of these tunes. Mm-hmm. Which maybe they're just bad tunes. That happens too. But like the fact that it doesn't sound like a quote-unquote bluegrass tune could be the could be a really good thing about it.
I was curious about your approach to improvisation and how you teach it, because it's based on chord changes and you have this jazz influence. So are you using chord substitutions? Like, how are you approaching that?
Yeah. Well, having gone to Berkeley, a big emphasis is analyzing a relationship between a note and a chord all the time. And so I think that's less of a given in like picker circles all over the country in bluegrass. I think it's, you can't presume everybody's doing that, but I think the people, a lot of people work towards that, and I think the best, the people who do it the best are all doing that. And I don't think of that necessarily as jazz. But yeah, that's a big important thing that, it's funny to teach this stuff because as a teacher, you want to teach people, things that they're going to get soon. But also that concept, I think is really key, and it's not a short lesson. It's an easy one to convey in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but the from understanding to using is a longer, much longer time period. So, but also you just like that's what I'm doing, so there's that tension there, like. I don't want to water it down. I want to say, if this is a D chord, knowing the relationship between how an F is going to sound versus an F sharp versus a G sharp, and being able to hear those sounds in your ear and then make choices based on that, I think is, for me, that's fundamental.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever have your students sing a line instead of using their instruments to help their improv?
I like that. I don't do that very often, but I like that concept. I think that's a really beautiful concept. I mean, you know, people talk about don't just run your fingers, yeah. And I think that's you know, big prevalent in the bluegrass and the mandolin world. So yeah, I love that.
Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, in terms of challenges that a lot of students have as a violinist, one of the biggest challenges I find is just coordination. That one hand's moving before the other. Does that also happen with the strumming?
Yeah, I think that's true. Although it seems like many things, like if you can convince people to slow it down to the slowest point, that you know, there's a point where you can slow it enough that you can do that, right? And I think that's the solution to the practicing things slowly, even though nobody wants to do it, is the solution, right, to most things.
And really hearing what's coming out.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And back to Minnesota. So you were, you're teaching yourself, but you didn't intend to go into music professionally.
Well, that's yeah, that's true. I mean, I didn't have any perception. I was just playing the mandolin, and I liked it. And I was getting as good as I could. There was a one of the big heroes in the Midwest and beyond is Peter Ostrushko, and I. Found his name in the phone book, and I asked him for some lessons, and he could not have been kinder. He was very kind. So that was, yeah, getting to know him and going to the bluegrass circles wherever I was living. I guess I remember the first time someone pointed out that they knew a musician, my friend Dave down in Iowa City is a harmonica player, and I was like, oh, okay, wow. So at some point I acknowledged that, you know, people somebody knew could be a musician. But yeah, I mean, I don't think I committed to trying to give it a whirl until I was 22 or 23, something like that.
And how did you hear about Berkeley and find out about the opportunity?
Well, there was a bunch of music coming from there. Casey Dreesen, mm-hmm. Perhaps you know him, fantastic multi-stylistic fiddler, was there as a student playing, and he was touring with Tim O'Brien, so I knew about that. And the band Crooked Still was starting, and the cellist Rashad Eggleston was there at the time, and I knew about him because, you know, I knew everything about Daryl, and he had this band called Fiddler's Four with Bruce Malsky and Michael Doucet and Rashad. And I loved that record, and I had another friend, Kip Jones, who's a fantastic improvising violin player. He's in that band, Ethel, and he happened to be from Duluth, which is where I'm from. And so I visited and improvised a little bit with him and Rashad, and there's been a couple of moments where I just had a window into this other improvising facility, the ability to converse, you know, with this language that I didn't really know, but I was able to, like with him and Rashad, like maybe one of them would just like gently raise one of their eyebrows and, you know, they've changed keys now or this kind of thing. It was just this beautiful, fascinating dance that I didn't know how to do, but I felt like it was happening there. And so it felt like it could be a good place for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've collaborated with Grant Gordy for many years. Many different groups. Do you want to speak to him?
Yeah, I mean, that's who I, you know, especially when I think about, like, sitting in an airport and just remembering how privileged I am, even if the flight's been canceled, he comes to mind. Like, been very lucky to play with him. He's one of the best acoustic guitar players, I don't know, ever. He's fantastic, and luckily we both have this deep love for bluegrass, and especially the Grisman sort of adventurous wing of the bluegrass world, but also, deep, or are both really interested in studying and processing jazz, and he's gone way down that. And so we have a lot of overlap in some of our curiosities and values. We've been very lucky to have this long relationship with him, and we've been in the band Mr. Sun. We toured with this banjo player, Danny Barnes, and we had a band with a European bass player for a while. And kind of, I guess it's kind of like we grew up, you know, like my whole adult life has been playing with him.
Yeah.
I think.
Mike Block, the cellist, you play with him. Does he always play standing up?
He does. I think we all, I think he, I don't, maybe it's actually purely, pragmatic. I think it's also part of his brand.
Yeah. So he has a special strap? I mean...
He invented it.
Yeah.
The Block strap.
Okay.
Yeah. Mike's amazing. I mean, he's a... a lot of people we mentioned are multi-stylistic, but I think he, as much as anybody, if not more so, is wildly multi-stylistic. You know, I've been in concerts where he's played, you know, duets with Rachel Barton Pine, right? And I forgot the piece. It's the one that Edgar Meyer plays on Uncommon Ritual, one of these virtuoso pieces. And then going straight from that to playing a bluegrass tune with me, and then straight from that to playing an African tune with I find it very inspiring how I don't think he's just kind of floating on the surface with each of these things. He's really conversant with the details and nuances of each of those styles in a way that I find very inspiring. Mm-hmm. Well, he's just a fantastic improviser too. So again, there's that common thread of like being able to share that language and converse in this way that isn't always, you know, sometimes it feels like that kind of thing is easier to do than talking.
Definitely, yes. One of the things about the series for me is just I think music is our most important language. And I just try to show people that a life in music is just means so many things. So it's great to also, with all of my guests, we do talk about people's collaborators and mentors because it just brings more in. I wish I could talk to all the hundreds of thousands of great musicians everywhere, but I won't have enough lifetimes to do that, so...
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important message to be saying. I mean, to also to us. I mean, I when I wake up, I sit here and I work on music and I practice and I try to get better at playing with a metronome. And then I think about what my wife is doing, which is that she's trying to keep people from being evicted. And it's not a big leap for me to say, what's more important here? She's keeping somebody in their house and I wrote a melody. And I think a lot of musicians, not everybody, but I have a lot of friends who are just aware of that. And I think it's really important to remember like what music can be and the way it builds community. And I mean, I don't have to tell you, I think you're probably, you know, as aware as anybody, but, it's an important message that I need to hear sometimes.
Yeah. Let's talk about your practice routine. What do you do to keep in shape?
Yeah. Well, I travel so much, so routine is not the word.
Yeah.
But when I'm home, it's all dependent on what I'm preparing for. So if I'm preparing for a record, then that's the priority and trying to, my big priority is improvising and the tunes that I like to record are, I think generally speaking in a larger subject, the stuff that we're recording, holds our interest if it has challenges. So then trying to assimilate, whether it's the rhythmic challenges or a harmony that maybe is unfamiliar, that sort of thing, I would spend a lot of time on. When I'm left to my own devices for a few weeks, I like to transcribe a lot. When I'm listening to a recording and I hear some improviser making choices that aren't intuitive or that I don't understand, that's a sign that I should probably learn that. That's a value of mine, like trying to broaden options and one thing that's funny about the mandolin is, especially in bluegrass, is almost, let's say, 99% of the time, if a note is on the beat, we play a downstroke, and if a note is on the offbeat, we play an upstroke. And so it's this very binary da 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 da, and all the rhythms that become intuitive if you make a big priority of playing that, all the rhythms da 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 ba da ba da, and then it becomes this we're kind of confined to the eighth note grid. And that's cool, and there's an argument for that. It's like the efficiency required to play bluegrass is resting on that, but there's all this other beautiful language that isn't served by that, and so that's a big thing that I try and transcribe. And one of my heroes is the great John Scofield, and at some point I realized that a lot of his language is about slurs. That's part of how he's making it sound that way, and it's also how he's generating streams of notes. And obviously he's playing the guitar and that's not a mandolin, but there is some overlap, and I've been transcribing some of his stuff trying to learn that too.
Mm-hmm. Do you play any banjo or guitar or other plucked instruments?
I have played a lot of guitar. At some point I had an injury and I stopped playing it, but I've spent a lot of time on guitar, yeah.
Was it because it's a bigger stretch for your left hand? Was that part of
it? It was actually the right arm. And when I moved to Maine, I was teaching maybe 20 hours a week of guitar lessons. And at some point, 20 hours of having my arm over the hip of a dreadnought became painful.
Okay. Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about injury prevention and staying relaxed. Oh. And
yeah, that's interesting. I don't know if you knew, but went through a big injury where, like, I was going to take time off the road in spring of March of 2020. So I actually was at this place where I was kind of panicked, where I was like, I don't think I can do these gigs. And then, obviously, they were all canceled. So that enforced, recess was very healthy for me, and I kind of got my stuff back together. I think people don't talk about it very much, but I think in the mandolin world, I think it's very common. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost universal amongst people of a certain age, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've developed arthritis, which is affecting my left hand. So just the stiffness in the joints that didn't used to be there.
Yeah, I think, Daryl has that, and I know him better than any other fiddle player of that age. Yeah. So I wouldn't speculate on anybody else, but yeah, it makes sense to me. I I mean, you know, five decades, six decades of that makes sense.
Yeah. I know you don't normally play solo, but would you be willing to pick up your mandolin? And then if you don't like what you play, we won't include it in this episode?
Yeah, sure. Of course. Well, let's see.
Beautiful, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
So, what was that?
I think it's an American tune called Chinkapin Hunting. I wonder where I learned it. There's a lot of tunes that I learned sort of at jams, and then I never have like a proper source. But it's sort of an old time tune.
Okay.
That was in vogue in the bluegrass world, you know, 15 years ago.
And the instrument that you're playing on, is that your primary mandolin?
Yeah, it's made by this Australian, Steve Gilchrist, and he's an amazing, fascinating creature. He had recordings of mandolins and saw a picture of a mandolin and decided to build an F5 mandolin, never having seen one in person. It's really preposterous. He's become the... You know, one of the two leading lights of the mandolin world. Really beautiful dude, and as I'm sure you've known, many musicians like he's, you know, the highest standard and unforgiving of his own work. I think,
mm-hmm.
just like, you know, the harsh critic and expecting the most from himself, which is why it works so well, I think.
Have you ever been to Australia?
No, I played in New Zealand with a Kiwi guitarist, but I never went to Australia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've interviewed a few Australian musicians, and I'll probably never get there, but I feel this connection. I was just interviewing somewhere last night, actually, because then you have to the night interview for the next day.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it seems like I think there's a healthy mandolin thing there. Actually, two of the best mandolin builders, you know, Paul Duff is another one, and he's... It's amazing. There's like that. Seems like a really awesome scene there. It's the mandolin is funny. It pops up everywhere. I went to Japan last year, and there's mandolin builders and like a really thriving scene for bluegrass music and sort of the related stuff there. It's really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that was like an old time tune, and I understand a little bit about old time branching off into bluegrass. But do you want to speak to that a little bit for people who don't understand?
Yeah, sure. It can mean a couple of things. I mean, it can mean like a collection of repertoire that comes from certain style, you know, certain fiddle players or banjo players. But it also tends to mean like how we approach playing a fiddle tune. So, and that's an easier distinction to make, which is like in bluegrass, let's say we played that tune. The obvious thing that would happen would be somebody would play the melody and then everybody else would, this is sort of like the low-hanging fruit way of arranging it. But with this approach, everybody else would take a solo and interpret the melody, maybe play the melody. But if the thing that would be funny would be if there was five of us in a row and we played the melody exactly the same, but once at a time, that actually wouldn't be stylistic for bluegrass. It'd be actually strange. And so the idea there is everybody takes a solo or has their moment. And then in old time, the conceit would be, here's the melody, we're going to play it for a long time, and everybody plays it. And I think sometimes the story is allowed to persist that there's no improvising. And I think that's wrong. In old time, it's just within a smaller spectrum of how much change we're making at a given moment. I think that's an interesting concept, being aware of, like, here's this, and then this whole spectrum of, like, how many changes we're allowing ourselves to improvise with. And in that case, with old time, you wouldn't, you know, harmonically, you wouldn't take any wild adventures, and it would mostly be about, like, tiny little melodic connections or adding syncopations, right? So, like, let's say the melody was... common stylistically to play the fourth beat of the measure prior to the downbeat of or that kind of thing is an example of, like, syncopating tiny little melodic notes. Mm-hmm. How are we should we get more into the weeds? I feel like I've buried myself in the weeds here with old time.
But I'm just always interested to talk about this stuff. I did an interview with Jane Rothfield, old-time fiddler, and she was saying how, I don't want to misquote her, but yeah, I forget the guy she was playing with, but he was mad that she was playing over a solo, because she came from this old-time world that you just all play together.
Oh, right.
You know, and it's definitely a different mindset.
Yeah, I mean, the bluegrass thing, I've kind of chafed at the concept, but I think it's a really beautiful one, which is the sense of, like, the way it's played... makes it as easy as possible to play with people you don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this huge shared repertoire and this nonverbal language of, like let's say, for example, like, if I hear somebody do this, I know the downbeat is here. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole bunch of stuff like that that allows it, you know, allows, for example, me to go to Japan and play with people who I can't even converse with, but we can have a bluegrass jam without any problem, and we know the same repertoire, and we could even do a gig, you know, reasonably well. And in some ways, the way bluegrass is played in that way kind of, makes it harder for you to have nuance, I think, mm-hmm. You lose some things along the way, but it's a beautiful, from a community perspective, I think it's a really beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful record that you're on that I, let me just check the title. Yeah, Bluegrass and the Abstract Truth. And there's a really great fiddler on there, Alex Hargreaves.
Yeah. Alex is such an inspiring musician, and he comes out of, like many of us, he was also inspired by Daryl, and is very much coming from that school. But also, he went to the... there's a college within the college at Berkeley, which is the Global Jazz Institute, and Alex was probably one of the first, if not the first, violin players to go and work with, like, Danilo Perez and Ben Street and Joe Lovano, and some of these just like the highest names in the jazz world. So Alex is uniquely nimble in both worlds and really able to turn one on and turn the other off or live in the middle. And living in the middle was the kind of the nature of that record.
Mm-hmm. And you guys got together to make that record. Did you tour it at all? Did you perform?
You know, going back to my concept of, like, the music, I'm just saying, like, I feel like the music is supposed to be enough. Not that we shouldn't tour it, but, like, it's like one of those records that where there was no commercial imperative to make that record. It was like, we just, as it happened, we were all hired to teach at this camp in England, this bluegrass camp called Sore Fingers.
Sore Fingers?
Yeah. Lovely community. Yeah. It's a really awesome thing. And one of the evenings they asked, we put on a concert. So we just, you know, put together a set from one night. And it was, this has happened a couple times where you play a set and then you come off and you're like, we didn't have to discuss anything. We're all pushing in the same direction. And it sounds like things are possible without having to, like, I think, like, you know, I think I have, you know, when things are easy, I feel like some musicians gravitate towards that, right? And that was that case there. Like, oh wow, we're all kind of, I think we love a lot of the same things and made things possible for each other. And so after that, we just decided to make a record that following summer, just because, again, you know, felt like the music was worth documenting or exploring. And then Alex joined Billy String's touring band. And schedule, you know, there's been a couple of gigs where, actually, Australia, where there was a gig in Australia and we had to turn it down. It's, scheduling is always the thing.
Yeah.
But.
Well, I don't know if you want to talk to them, if we could use a track. I'd love to point people in the direction of that album. Do you want to reach out to them?
Oh, great. Yeah, please.
Yeah?
Talk to, I'm sure they'd be happy
yeah?
with
it. Yeah. So I was thinking maybe Mahjong. Is it?
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. That's funny. That's a perfect, Mahjong is funny because, like, for anybody that doesn't know, it's a Wayne Shorter tune.
Oh, okay.
And you know, for me, Wayne Shorter represents like, whoa, this is the heavy stuff that's harder to parse as an improviser. And oddly enough, what they wanted to do, and I think it was cool, is like play this Wayne Shorter tune as an old time tune, I think. So it kind of ties in. It's funny, like repertoire is—it's of course not old time, but like at least through the lens of the four of us that day, that was sort of an old time rendering of a Wayne Shorter tune.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about memorizing tunes?
Yeah, I think it's like if it's in my ear, I can play it, right? And so, it, for me, it's mostly about listening. You know, I don't like being on a gig and visualizing, like, here's the chart, here's the E7 chord at that bar. It's mostly about hearing it and knowing the sounds, which, you know, I there's always room for growth in that, in terms of like I should be better at recognizing certain modulations or this kind of movement. But like, yeah, trying to hear things, and if I can hear it in my head. And I'm pretty good at analyzing stuff, so I can say, okay, well, that's this chord, and that implies this. That's, for better or for worse, that's where I'm at. Mm-hmm. So, like, as I go to a gig, I would much rather have a long playlist that I've internalized and listened to, while cooking or driving or whatever, than trying to memorize it from charts.
Yeah, that was, actually, I was curious. So when you were doing these picking circles as a young man learning, was it all by ear, and then later came the charts? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mostly there's some resources online for, but at that point I didn't realize that ear was really gonna work better.
Yeah. This is Mahjong from the album Bluegrass and the Abstract Truth, with Greg Garrison, Grant Gordy, Alex Hargreaves, and Joe K. Walsh. The link on Bandcamp is in the show notes for this podcast. Thank you. Oh, yeah. I believe you have a funny story about meeting Joe Walsh of the Eagles, because, of course, people look up Joe Walsh, musician.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, even now, I get Joe Walsh jokes, you know, regularly, but on the road it was all the time, especially with the Gibsons. So one time they were given an honorary doctorate to Joe Walsh at Berkeley, and someone arranged for us to be to meet and say hello, and that was cool, and he was nice. I really wanted to go with the opening line, like, I really wanted to say, "Hey Joe, I'm really sorry, you hear about me all the time, and you must be really tired." But I chickened out. And he had this handler there. I don't know, some guy who was just whatever. And he kind of intercepted me and shook my hand and passed me a Joe Walsh pick, which was kind of funny. I guess nobody knows what to do when you meet somebody with your same name, and I don't know. And then his wife, what did she say? She said, "Oh, it's nice to meet you. It's nice to be married to you." And I feel like that was my cue to leave.
Well, I'd like to wrap this up with maybe just some reflections. I was curious because you know, we talked a little bit about the confidence of youth, and then you kind of alluded a little bit to a bit of imposter syndrome as you've gained in experience and the mental game. Where's the mental game most important for you? Is it more in performing or?
Yeah, I mean, performing is just trying to recognize, like, what conditions I thrive in. Mm-hmm. So performing, of course, and then recording. But also, like, again, like, as I composed, like, just trying to, like, it's so easy to reject. It's so natural to reject. I listened actually to a beautiful podcast from this guy Pablo Held last week, and this guitarist Jacob Bro was on there, and he was talking about when he's composing, he gives himself a period of, like, let's say 2 weeks where there's no critique.
Yeah.
Just no, which, like, I mean, what a beautiful concept. I was just like, that's what I need to do, because I can't, you know, a lot of times when I'm composing, I can't go 5 minutes without saying, "Oh, this is stupid."
Mm.
This is so that is really important. I don't know. It's. I think it's an always an evolving thing, and just trying to acknowledge, like, what's holding my interest, and then being aware that that's what I should be doing. And it's not always what we do, I don't think. I think, you know, probably every music has this these formulas that you can recognize, and then you know, work on and channel. But I think, like, it's things work best when we are saying, "This is what I'm interested in. I'm willing to say that, and you may not be interested in it, but here I am." And so that's, like, moving more and more towards that, and less towards, here's this thing that is of this formula.
Mm-hmm. That's some great wisdom there. Well, thanks so much for this, Joe. It's really great to talk to you.
It was great to have the time with you. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. The link is in the description. Have a wonderful week.